We are on the record, as we say. The suggestion was made that we have a series of classes regarding kashrus in the kitchen and kashrus and issues related to Shabbos in the kitchen, and that's what we hope to do over the next few weeks. This is what we call a refresher course, and no one should be shy about asking questions as we go along.
We should have this discussion.
That was pretty quick.
We haven't even started yet. But is this
playing the role of Patty today?
Kosher in the home kitchen or the shul kitchen?
Well, kosher is really the same in any kitchen that you are, I'll be honest.
Okay,
right. The men are kosher. I don't know why.
The men are the ones who go in that kitchen and don't do things they shouldn't do.
The reason that this is a women's shear, this is not a misogynistic comment.
No, why don't you tell them that, really? Because they're the ones.
The reason that this is a women's shear is twofold. One is because Aggie requested it, and I'll note she didn't. I know she's not here.
But she wanted it only for women.
Well, no, she wanted instead of the Navi class that we should have this.
Are
that
you was kidding me?
Ha ha! It's hilarious, huh? No.
Yeah, and
second fold, I think the assumption is that the women tend to cook more than the men do.
Thank God.
Right.
We are already in a generation. Avi's a major cook.
Avi makes a wonderful chillant, and that's the reason. If someone has issue with it, we can consider it. But again, this isn't a matter of who's partrafing what. This is a we haven't even started yet. This is just an overall halacha class. Period. Game, set, match. The basically issues that are related to kosher in the kitchen or kosher anywhere for that matter are really fall into two different halachic categories. One is there is food that is not kosher. Whether it's a non-kosher animal or whatever else it is, that is issue number one. And issue number two is you have kosher foods which cannot be mixed together, namely milk and meat. The majority of questions that I get involve the second category, right? You'll hear a person say, we accidentally used a milchik spoon in our cholent. You'll rarely hear someone say, I accidentally stirred the chum with my pig. That's rare, shall we say. Right? So again, the majority probably we'll be talking about are the issues of what's called tarovis, when milk and meat get mixed together in a way that they shouldn't have. But today I'd like to start with issues that do not relate to milk and meat. I'd like to talk about overall kosher issues. Regarding what is kosher, what is not kosher, so the world has changed radically over the last century. Your mother, grandmother, would actually have kosher questions. She would buy a chicken, and the chicken would have a broken wing, and you'd have to go to the rabbi and say, is this a kosher chicken or not? The world has changed. No one buys live chickens anymore and takes them to the shochet. All the chickens come the same way, wrapped in plastic. Rabbi Willig, who's been a rabbi for over 40 years in the synagogue, once mentioned to me that in all of his years, he only once received a question. On an Erev Shabbos, an older woman knocked on his door, and she had a chicken wing in her hand, and she said, Rabbi, is this kosher? And he turned to her and said, what did it say on the wrapping? And she said, empire. He said, kosher. It has gotten to the point, actually, where the smicha studies have changed. When I went to smicha, which I don't think was that many years ago, one of the first things you had to learn was shechita, the laws involving shechting an animal, shechting a chicken, salting the animal, salting the chicken. That has since been dropped from the curriculum because it's just not practical anymore. It doesn't come up. All of the shechting, all of the salting, all of the preparation happens before it reaches the home. It all happens in Postville, Iowa. There's Aggie, you can go yell at her now. And that's what...
We will.
I'm sure. So therefore, what food is kosher, shall we say, per se, is really not as much of an issue. what is kosher comes down to a question nowadays of hashgachas, that there are markings here in America on all of the potentially kosher foods, and some of them are come from rabbis or organizations that are absolutely trustworthy. There are some of them that come from organizations that are absolutely not trustworthy, and there are some in between. So we're not going to go now down the list, but there are lists that are readily available in terms of what is kosher per se. That is a question of hashgachas. There are certain foods out there that we know that you can buy without a hashgacha. The most obvious choice is fruits and vegetables. Fruits and vegetables, you go to Pete, you go to King Super, you go to wherever you need to go, and there's nobody who's telling you that it's kosher, but you just go and straight up buy it and it is fine. That in America is okay in most cases. The exception is imported produce which comes from Israel. We are very Zionistic, as we'll say tomorrow night, and we do want to support the state of Israel. However, Israel has problems that we don't have. The problems that Israel has is what's first called trumos in Maisrus. Any produce that grows in Israel, a certain amount has to be given to the Kohen, a certain has to be given to the Levi, a certain amount is supposed to be taken to Yerushalayim, given to poor people, etc. In the event that produce grows in Israel and it does not have the trumos and maisrus taken, that is called tevel, and if a person eats that, they get misa bidei shamayim. Eating olives from Israel that you did not take trumas and maisa is worse than eating a pig. If you would eat a pig, that would only be only malchus, lashes you would get. I asked everyone to please turn off their ringers. They don't mind.
Wait, the punishment was cutting, being cut off?
What death, heavenly death.
Heavenly death.
Oh, right. It's heavenly.
Is that a spiritual death?
No. The difference is it's not as good as it sounded, Marcia. Wow, if you gotta go, heavenly death sounds wonderful. No. It means as follows: in the event that somebody is a murderer, so you are taken to a court and killed by the courts down here. In the case of the heavenly death, the court doesn't kill you, but rather the good Lord strikes you down. Which is really not that great anymore, if you think about it. So that's misa bidei shamayim. So in fact, in the event that someone eats Israeli produce, where trumas and maisos have not been taken off, that is actually, potentially, worse than actually eating a pig.
Wow.
Right? So that is something you have to be careful about.
How
so,
do you know which important one is imported?
Do they have a heksher for that?
So they do have a heksher, but in general, when we buy our fruits and vegetables, they don't come with a heksher. In Israel, if a person was shopping in Israel and you were going to buy produce, you would have to buy it in a store that has a heksher.
The store has the heksher?
Yes, so you go to the fruit store. So Pete would have the heksher.
What about imported olives and things like that?
Right, so in the event that I'm buying a can of olives or something, so then you'll have to have a heksher on the side, like any other can that you likely buy.
Right.
If it has a heksher, it's fine. It's very interesting. I'll tell you a story one time. So there's an apple juice, Apple and Eve. You get it here on the number, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So Apple and Eve has an OU on it. And one time I got my apple, and it also says where it comes from. These apples are from USA, from Brazil. So I once got one that came from Israel, that they had made Apple and Eve apple juice out of Israeli apples. Now, that's strange, because Israel doesn't have that many apples.
No.
Right? Israeli apples, one thing that's very... Have you ever eaten an apple in Israel?
No.
You ever buy it? You ever see an apple in Israel?
Yes.
Why?
They don't look good.
They don't look good. Why don't they look good?
They look wild.
What? So the reason they don't look is because they're not shiny. Have you noticed that?
None of Israeli fruits and vegetables
are shiny.
They don't wax.
Correct.
They don't wax it.
They don't wax their fruits. Do you know why they don't wax their fruits?
Kosher.
For kosher reasons, actually. Where does the wax come from?
Bees.
So some of it is beeswax. Some of it is shellac. I think 25% of them is shellac. Where does shellac come from?
Like what you put on your door.
Right, but it doesn't come from my door. Where did my door get it from, though?
Oh, well, I mean, you're talking about shellac that you put. It's the same thing, the same product, mm-hmm. or similar?
Isn't it like a synthetic product?
It's all natural.
Yeah.
From bugs. The lac bug. So we assume in America that it is kosher. Of course, you might want to think twice before you eat it. But in Israel, they assume many opinions hold that both shellac and beeswax is not kosher. Right? So that's why the apples in Israel don't look so good, because they're not shiny, because they don't make them shiny. But they do taste good, right? Apples have real issues in Israel. So apples, for starters, has the standard trumas and maisers issues that you have. Next, the issues that they have that we haven't yet mentioned is Shemitah. Once every 7 years, you can't eat it at all. And then there's a third problem. When you read in the Torah, it sounds very, very theoretical, but there are certain rules when it comes to gifts to the poor. So there's something called peah, for example, that you have to leave a corner over. Shikha, right? That things that fall. Also, another thing they talk about is orla. People know what orla is? What's orla? Okay, you're fine. You can do it.
That's the only one I don't know what it is.
Oh, okay.
It comes into play in circumcision, doesn't it?
The first 3 years.
I don't know. That's the one I heard of.
Yes.
That you can't eat the fruit the first 3 years.
Correct. You're not allowed to eat the fruit of a tree in the first 3 years. And what about in the fourth year?
You have to eat it in Yerushalayim.
You have to eat it in Yerushalayim. Right. So for the first 4 years, you cannot eat the fruit of a tree. The foreskin is known as orla as well. And in fact, there was a very funny translation on a bottle of wine recently where it said that there's no problems of Shemitah, no problems of Orla, and they translate it's not from the Shemitah year, and there's no foreskin. which I'm sure made people...
So I wasn't totally off base.
You were no more off base than they were. I'll give you that. We'll give you that. Be careful when you drink that wine, Sharon. Just telling you. So Orla is not such a problem, because when you first grow trees, the first few years it doesn't really produce fruits. The one exception are apples. Apples actually do produce fruits pretty quickly, and by the second, third, fourth year you will be getting apples. So that's another issue that comes up. So when it comes to the fruits of Israel, there are significant issues, and therefore you have to be careful. So if you're shopping in Israel, so unlike America where fruit stores do not have hashgachas, in Israel fruit stores do have hashgachas, so any fruit store that you go into Israel, you have to be very careful with this. Because as we said, if they did not take the requisite truma and maaser from it, it is actually worse than, potentially, assuming it's the raisa, worse than it could be eating a pig. So you'd really, if you're going to do that, might as well eat the pig, it's probably better, if you're going to do it one way or the other. So that's issue number one. You have to be very careful. Which produce come from Israel? What are the ones?
Dates.
So oranges, potentially, the Jaffa oranges. Dates, absolutely.
Carrots
a big problem in New York. My wife is talking from experience, because in New Jersey, where we shop, they're very proud. They try to, you know, buy a lot of Israeli produce, thinking that the Jewish kosher consumers will be very excited about that. And in fact, it just messes us up. So we ended up with a bag of Dorot carrots, which we had real problems about. So what do you do if you end up with this? So Costco sells Israeli oranges.
You have to do the truma and the maisa.
Right? Peppers are very common. Maisa. From time to time, you'll get mangoes also. Little known fact that Israel is the most northern country in the world that grows mangoes.
Oh, right.
All right, so what do you do if in the event that you end up, if you accidentally buy it?
You gave a shear on this.
Right, so we gave a shear of this, and there's what to be done about this, right? You can take truma, you can take maaser, there's a way to make it better. However, if it's during a Shemitah year, there's nothing you can do about it. Basically, you have to just leave it outside until it rots, and then you can throw it out at that point. So in terms of fruits and vegetables, the only thing you have to be careful about is to make sure that it's not Israeli produce. We love Israel. We'd be happy to buy their produce, but we just have to know somehow or another that the trumas and maishas have been taken.
To what extent do you have to be concerned? Like if you go to the supermarket and it doesn't say Israeli oranges, you're just buying oranges, do you have to look for the...
No, you don't have to. There's no... But usually these things are marked. More in general, when you buy your produce, if you look closely...
It says California or USA or Mexico or
Chile. Chile, mm-hmm. Chile. All winter it says Chile. Mm-hmm.
In some cities, they have these grocery stores, they're kosher stores, but they have fruits and vegetables and they advertise them as, cucumbers from Israel.
Right, so if the store is under a hashgacha, then you would assume. So it's interesting. There's a funny machlokas. So in general, if I was in Israel and I would want to make apple juice, right? So what I would do is I would take my apples from the tree, I would take off the trumas and maizers, and then I would squeeze it. What if I squeezed it first? Can I take the trumas and maizers off the apple juice? So that was actually a machlokas between the Chazon Ish and the Bris Kerov, two great rabbis in Bnei Brak. So when I ended up with my Apple and Eve Israeli apple juice, it had an OU on it, but I wanted to know, did the OU take the trumas and maizes before they made the juice or after they made the juice? So I called up the Orthodox Union.
Because you were curious?
What?
Because you were curious?
Yeah. Oh. I wanted to know, is there a reason to be concerned? Because if they take it after they made juice, according to some opinions, it's problematic. So I called up and I got a secretary and I said, I have a question. She said, what's your question? I said, it's regarding, I have this apple and Eve orange juice. It's Israeli. So she said, yes, it has an OU on it. So I said, I was curious. Could I find out when they take the trumas and maestras? To which this secretary says to me, you think we don't know about the Chazon Ish and the Bris Kerov?
Educated secretaries.
How much of a percentage is truma?
What?
So
the amount that you take for truma is a de minimis amount, any small amount. But miser is 10% and truma's miser is 1%.
Okay,
so the total amount that's going to come off is around 12%, but the amount that you can't eat is only around 2%.
So, I understand that question because apples was probably... You need to take more apples off than more of the juice.
Why?
Because it takes a lot of apples to make a little juice. That's why you were...
So again, because if I had 10 apples, then I would have to take one apple. If I squeezed it, I would have to take 10% of the juice.
No.
Why no?
It makes very little. One apple
But it's still 10%.
Little.
Right, but percent is percent. Right. Either way, I'm going to put 90% of these. I'm going to put the same amount of apple juice, won't I?
Yes. Conservation of apple juice.
Conservation of apple juice.
So what was the answer?
What?
So what was the answer?
So they, in fact, did take it as apples. They were well aware of it, and don't get smart with them. Right? What? Before the OU gives a hashgacha on apple and Eve. When they use apples from Israel, the OU makes sure that trumas and maizers are taken beforehand. Speaking of apple juice, there are certain products out there which do not require a hashgacha.
Mm-hmm.
Including them is apple juice.
100%.
When I think 100% apple juice, either natural or from concentrate, does not require a hashgacha. Orange juice, 100% orange juice, we assume does not require hashgacha. Bottled water does not require a hashgacha. Many types of dried fruits do not require a hashgacha. So, no. So again, you don't have to look at either. You can just walk over, take anything off the shelf, any 100% apple juice, and buy it without the hashgacha or not. So it's so rare.
Story.
Right. So again, unless it says it's from Israel, which is, in all of my years, I've seen that once. Right. So California dates, you can buy without a hashgacha as well.
So what are the dry fruits that you want to buy without hashgacha?
So anything where there's no concern, where again, I can get you a list. Actually, the local VAD has a list. And don't worry, they're not too make up.
But what if they have, like, sulfur dioxide in it?
Sulfur dioxide is fine. Right? Just like plain milk you can buy without a hashgacha. I asked, one time I was speaking to Rabbi Ganak, and I noticed as follows, that there was a certain dairy which produced two brands of milk. One brand was Chalav Yisrael, and the other brand was not Chalav Yisrael, but the one that was not Chalav Yisrael had an OU on it. So I asked him, is that really Chalav Yisrael as well? So he said, no. So I said, so what does the OU do with that milk? He said, we confirmed that the vitamin A and the vitamin D are kosher. I said, oh, are there vitamin A's and vitamin D's that are not kosher? He said, no. So I said, so what do they do? They take a paycheck, you know, and they allow them to use the symbol. It's very interesting. Apple juice happens to be one of the more interesting cases because if you naturally squeeze apple juice, it's cloudy. And therefore, they clarify it. How do you clarify your apple juice?
Let's filter it.
You could filter it. That's one way to do it.
Centrifuge it.
Okay. No. What? No, so believe it or not, one of the ways you can do it is you can take pig fat and put it in, and that will absorb the stuff and then take it out. Many forms of apple juice do that in order to clarify. If you do that, the OU still gives you an OU.
The 1/60th thing, or what?
Right. We'll get to that.
That's gross. How do I know if they're going to do
you
that?
You don't. If they have an OU anyway, you can't
if you buy. If you buy natural apple juice, the cloudy stuff, they didn't do it.
Ah.
Okay? All right, so again, if this concerns you, that would be the way to do it. But again, fruits and vegetables generally do not require a hashgacha. You just have to be concerned about Israeli produce. And there are other products as well which do not require hashgacha. And there are lists that are out there about what you can buy from there and or what you cannot. So it depends on the fruit. That's why I said most dried fruits.
It's an issue with the dates right. In Israel.
It's an issue with dates. It's an issue with figs. But then again, with the hashgacha, it doesn't make it any better.
No, it doesn't.
Right. Unlike your lettuce, where they can check it for you and clean it for you, if there's a bug in your fig, the only way you're going to find it is by ripping it open. And you'll note that if they didn't rip it open beforehand, nobody really knows.
How will the bug make it into your fig?
Oh, it's clever.
Worms get into apples, I understand.
Don't you have a hole in the apple then?
What?
Don't you have a hole in the apple then?
So a very small one. One that might not
sometimes
necessarily
it can
seem...
come in the
right,
stem.
Also, oftentimes they say it comes in early and it kind of just eats in there and grows with it.
Cool. Lovely.
Is that a worm do this or other buggies?
All sorts of buggies.
Well, I don't have a bug.
You do? Maybe she get a frog.
Okay.
So. If you've ever had a bad fig or a bad date that's infested, you will see it very quickly.
Well, in Israel, Miriam
right.
splits them, all the dates open.
Right, but again, she just splits it. She doesn't inspect.
No, you could see.
Right, once if it's got a problem, you'll see it right away.
But you should split your figs and your dates, and you don't have to split them.
You should.
Yeah.
What if they're dependent dates? Like, with the pits removed?
Doesn't matter.
What about dice dates?
Oh, those should be okay.
What?
Dice dates. You can
right.
see.
Now, yes. If you make Sharon's fruit muffins, you have to use diced dates, right? Right. Okay.
I'm not standing there and dicing. I'm not buying those. So wait, so is that okay or not?
So again, you buy that with a hashgacha. If you buy with anything with a hashgacha, it does not have any issue. If it's a good hashgacha, you're done. Move on. That's it.
But you just said that if
what?
The dates
have... Right. In terms of,
you still have to check them.
Right. If they're whole, but if they're diced, the assumption is they're good. Now, very interesting. We should talk a little bit about the issue of bugs. There is a wide range of opinions regarding issues of bugs with fruits and vegetables and the like. This will upset you a little bit, but it is the halacha. What?
If you're going to upset us, I'm not going to come anymore.
He just doze off. It's okay. This is actually a kula, in terms of it's not upsetting because of that, but the halacha is as follows. In the event that I have, there's a problem of eating bugs when they are whole. If you have parts of bugs, if it is a minority of the amount of food that you have, that's not a problem. So, for example, spinach would have to be checked for bugs. Let's have a look. If you buy pureed, for sure, spinach, that's no problem. Because even if it was 48% bugs, it would still be kosher. I told you it was a little upsetting.
I know this already.
What?
This is not new.
Okay. Right, so therefore, whenever you...
There goes your protein.
Right? No, it's good. It's good for the protein.
Yeah.
Right? So therefore, even if somebody is very careful with strawberries, if someone's very careful with whatever it is, if you're going to blend it, you're going to make it into a smoothie, no problem. Kale has to be checked. A kale smoothie has no problem whatsoever. Right? Strawberries, maybe yes, maybe no. But in the event that you go and you blend your strawberries into a strawberry soup or the like.
So you're saying we don't have to wash the 15 pounds of strawberries every time
until you make strawberry soup?
We don't have to wash 15 pounds.
You don't want dirt in it.
You don't want dirt in it. Exactly.
You don't mind the bugs, but you don't want dirt.
Mm-hmm. Right, so as long as it's going to be blended, or if you buy it blended, finely chopped, being chopped enough that you're not going to get a full bug in there, then there is no problem according to everybody. Yes.
So, and what about frozen?
Don't they?
What do you mean?
If they have much stuff in them, they're okay. No?
What?
Don't frozen burst or whatever.
Do they?
Burst bugs.
I don't think so. But again,
what was the question?
They do?
Frozen fruit bugs.
Sorry.
Well, they would be dead.
Yeah?
Yeah, but dead is not the issue. Coal is the issue.
Yeah?
You don't need to check for bugs. You just need to rinse it.
Well, for some reason, there are people who eat frozen strawberries and don't eat
it. Well, again, I imagine if you freeze it first and then you wash water, it won't be clinging on anymore, practically. Right, because they've been frozen.
If you buy fresh spinach,
yes,
and you wash it off, and you put it in your food processor, and you
so once you it's done. It's interesting. When many years ago, before I was married, I was home for Pesach, and my mother gave me the job to check the maror for the bugs. Right. So I went and I took this stuff out of the bin, and it was so infested. 20, 30 bugs, and I went through every one, and I washed it, and finally, you know, after I'd done washing it, I bagged it, you know, and tied it up and put it back. And then I went upstairs, and my mother called me. She said, "When are you going to do the romaine lettuce?" And I yelled down, "I did it already." She said, "No, you didn't." I said, "Yes, I did. They're in bugs. They're in bags." I was 40 and was that. And they're in the bin. So she yelled back, "No, that's the spinach for the salad." So when it comes to leafy vegetables, that's the only place where I have ever really found a serious issue.
But if you find it infested, you just throw it away. You start over.
It's a good plan, probably. What? Or you can always puree it. Nothing like a romaine smoothie.
Yeah.
What?
Do we believe? I know this sounds disturbing, but people eat bugs these days. So, do we believe that we could just
on purpose put bugs in our smoothies?
No, we do not. No. We do not believe this. So don't get any ideas. Right? There's a concept which we'll get in weeks from now. We'll discuss called Ein Mevatlin Isser L'Chachila. If something falls in, it's different than if you put it in. Right? So therefore, for example, this was a major issue with Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola, around 25 years ago, so for many years, there's a fellow named Rabbi Simcha Elberg who gave the hashgacha on Coca-Cola. Rabbi Elberg was a single rabbi. He didn't have an organization, but everyone trusted him. You know, and it's kind of odd because Coca-Cola is a major operation.
One guy.
Coca-Cola is a very major operation, you know, worldwide, and they have secret ingredients and, you know, on the secret formula. So eventually, unfortunately, Rabbi Elberg passed on, and it was time they needed to get a new hashgacha. So they began talking with different organizations, and they said, but we're not going to tell you what the secret ingredients are. It's our formula. And they said, well, we can't really give you a hashgacha if we don't know what's in it. So for some time, Coca-Cola actually did not have hashgacha. I remember I was in camp at the time, and they took out all the Coke machines. They put in Pepsi machines over this. Right? This was a major change for us. You know, and they also had their therapist that helped us work through it. It was actually very funny because they were at this impasse. So Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, so Coca-Cola is in Atlanta. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman was the rabbi in Atlanta at the time. So he was trying to negotiate with them how exactly they'll be able to get a hashgacha without having to worry about their corporate secrets. So he wrote this tongue-in-cheek article, which was excellent at the time. He said, here's my idea. We're going to take a fellow, one of the mashgichim, and he, together with the chairman of the board and the president of the Coca-Cola company, will be led in. He will be shown the secret ingredients and the formula. He will then walk out with them to the gate, and he will confirm to us that everything is kosher. He will testify. He will give edus. They will then take him back and shoot him. And based on that, and it was a good article. He said, you know, and the guy should get a few extra dollars pay over this, given the situation. But so what was the big deal? 99% of what's in Coke, everybody knows. 1% is less than a 60th. So that was the concern, that if you're putting it in purposely, then it's no good. We generally assume that if something is triple washed, that's good enough. So if you buy a bag of lettuce or a bag of spinach and it's been triple washed, my wife has been checking. Have you ever found anything in a triple washed bag?
No, we don't check it that close.
No, I mean, nothing's ever crawled out of the salad, you know, waved.
What about thoroughly washed? Sometimes the bag says thoroughly washed.
So I would take a look at it to see if it is thoroughly washed, what it means. But a triple wash, I think we assume, generally takes care of any potential issues.
If it says on the bag, triple wash, you're okay.
Yeah. Worth the whole trip here just for that, huh? Have you been checking it?
I've been doing the chazaka bag.
And have you found anything?
You have, yeah. In what kind of bag? I can't vouch that it's triple wash. I just buy whatever.
Okay.
Very
right, so...
Please
do.
What's the chazaka?
Right. Yeah, we have found in bagged romaine hearts, etc. That we have found in, but not in
not.
Right.
Yeah, not, I don't use the chazaka method for that. I'm talking about spinach.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So meaning you check
all that kind of. Yeah. Well, I put them in with the spray, let them sit, and then I take them out vigorously, washing off the water, and then I look at the water, see if there's any bugs. If there are no bugs, then I check like it's a couple different leaves in three different sections. If there are bugs, I repeat the process until there are no bugs. That's in the
manual.
Is that on a bag or just regular?
A bag.
But, I mean,
a wash bag, you mean?
In terms, the next issue I'd like to talk about is Tefillas Kelim. There is a halacha that comes up actually in next week's parsha, not this week's parsha, which says as follows, that in the event that somebody acquires a vessel from a non-Jew, it is necessary to take that vessel to the mikvah. So, with that in mind, pretty much everything that we get in America, this is the reverse of the fruit, if you buy a knife that came from Israel, you don't have to tovel it, right? Most of what we buy, so again, a kiddush cup, generally, you don't have to be tovel, assuming it comes from Hatzarfim, where most of them come from. It was Israeli, it was made by a Jew, and as such, you don't have to tovel it. Everything else, whether it comes from made in America, in China, that was made by a non-Jew, and therefore, you have to do Tevilas Kelim. Not everything needs to do Tevilas Kelim. The Chumash tells us, gives a list of what you need Tevilas Kelim are. It gives a list of six metals: gold, silver, copper, lead, tin, and iron. Those are the six. There is a discussion whether it's those six specifically, or those just the six metals that they were aware of at the time, but it indicates all types of metal. That's important because most, I'd say, of the flatware that we have nowadays tends to be made out of
stainless steel.
Or
lead. It's got lead.
Aluminum. Mm-hmm. Aluminum. There's titanium as well. But I'm saying that those are different alloys, but definitely if you're going to buy aluminum, which is very, very common, right, the question is that an issue or not? So the Gemara tells us that according to the Torah, it's only metal. However, rabbinically, you also have to tovel glass, because glass has certain properties that are similar to metal. Why is glass similar to metal? Because
it's not porous.
Right. If you break it, you can heat it and put it back together. Right? So you can do that with metal. You can do that with glass. You cannot do that with clay, for example. Therefore, you do not have to tovel earthenware. What about China?
Some people think it's like glass, right?
So China is sprayed with a very light covering of glass. We assume that you do not have to tovel it. No forms of China. So any potteryware, any earthenware, any china, fine or otherwise, does not have to be tovelled.
Why do some people tovel their earthenware anyway?
Some people tovel it because I think they're worried about the fact that it's glazed. But not so much. So therefore, what?
Not fine china. What's the other one with the P?
Porcelain
is
a kind of earthenware, isn't it?
Porcelain is earthenware. You do not
have to.
Have to.
Oh, really?
No. Porcelain. However, the other thing with the P, the Pyrex, you do have to, we assume.
Yes. Well,
right. That's like glass.
Right. Right. So Pyrex, we assume that you do have to. Not everyone agrees with that. There are people who say that even Pyrex, you don't have to because it's chemically different. Rabbi Tendler holds that it is. I think that's a minority opinion. We do
so
do
anything
that.
Anything that's stainless or aluminum, you don't have.
No, stainless is a kind of iron.
So going back to our original question, what about stainless, what about aluminum? Even if you tell me that it's not on the Torah's list, aluminum is no different than glass, because aluminum can also be melted down and put back together. So therefore, we assume that all forms of metal have to be toveled, and we also assume that glass has to be toveled. However, nothing else, not wood, not any type of earthenware, and also not plastic. Now, there is an opinion out there that you have to tovel plastic because there are certain plastics that if you heat them, you can remold them. The overwhelming majority of our plastic is not that way. And even if it is, we assume even that case not.
What about aluminum foil pants?
Aluminum foil pants tend to be made out of aluminum foil. Right. And that would be a problem. However, there is an opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein has the opinion that anything that is disposable, anything that we say is chad pa'ami, is in fact not a problem.
You can't use it twice.
Right. Meaning that if it's something that was made only once, that is not considered a kli. It's not considered a vessel. Right? A vessel is something that is repeatedly used. Therefore, in the event that somebody has an aluminum pan, the majority opinion is you don't have to tovel it.
Even if you use it, if
you're going to use it more than once, then you do have to tovel it. So, for example, let's say I buy a bottle of Snapple. So, it's not toveled. and it's mine. So since what most people do is after they drink their Snapple, they throw it in the garbage, that's why we don't have to tovel it. Rav Schechter disagrees. Rav Schechter doesn't buy this idea that if something is a temporary vessel, it's not considered a vessel. And therefore, Rabbi Schechter is of the opinion that you have to tovel your aluminum pans. Not only that, Rabbi Schechter also does not drink his Snapple from the bottle. So again, if they're using it as a water bottle afterwards, they'll have to tovel it beforehand.
I once mentioned that to a kid in my class, and she told me that's
absolutely
crazy.
So that could be true, but that's not related to this in any way. Right? We're not saying yes or no. But we're saying that I think everyone would agree on that. If you're going to reuse your Snapple bottle or your Hellman's jar, but they're plastic now. They used to be.
Yeah, they're plastic.
Right? Or the baby food jars. What about soda cans? What? Right. If you're going to go and you're going to put the
soda cans, you can't reuse those.
So it happens to be when it comes to soda cans, there is more room to be makeable than bottles, because soda cans. When I buy a soda can, it's not a cli. A cli is something that you can put things into. A vessel you have to put things into and take things out of. A soda can is sealed on all sides. It only becomes a kli when I open it, when I pop the top. Now, I am Jewish. So if I pop the top, I'm the one who made the can.
You made the vessel.
Right,
you
so therefore.
Into a bottle until you open it either.
No, it's different. A Snapple bottle. It is a bottle. It works by itself, right? They're going to put a cap on it. I'm going to remove the cap. I'm going to just remove the cap that they had on it. However, by a soda can, that thing, what I'm popping, has never been opened before. Right? So I am the one who's actually making it. Yes? So if Sergio opens it up for you.
Right, let's say
it's Sergio. Okay. And let's assume Sergio's not Jewish for the time being. Okay? What? Well, we know better. Right, so again, that's no worse than the aluminum pan. Assuming you're a person who does not tovel their aluminum pans, then this is no problem.
Because it's going to be thrown away.
Right. You're not going to use it afterwards. This is the one time. People get confused about this. Right? People think that, this means I get to use it one time before I tovel it. Right? Sometimes, I'll have people call me up and they'll say, I just got a new set of flatware. I haven't had a chance to tovel it, but we're having guests for Shabbos. Can I use it one time?
How would that be different? I mean, why?
Because it's not disposable. Nobody buys a set of flatware and then throws them out.
So why would you think you could use it?
Because people get confused. People get confused the idea that if I'm only going to use it one time, as opposed to I get a free pass. Right, that's the confusion.
Okay, what if you're using a foil pan, and you either line it with aluminum foil that you're going to toss, or it's totally lined with parchment paper that you're going to toss? Can you use the foil pan again?
So in the event that the foil would be strong enough to be used on its own without the pan, then you can. However, if not, which I think is usually the case, then that wouldn't help. If a person is really, really stuck, so let's say it happens that you just came to town, you just moved in, you just bought, this set of flatware, and the mechutanim are coming for the first time, it's a tremendous shas adachak, it's an emergency, and you didn't have a chance to tovel it, you thought there was a mikvah, and there wasn't a mikvah actually, something crazy like that, right? So is there anything you can do? So there actually is an out. Let's say I go to a restaurant, right? I'd say the majority of restaurants in Manhattan are not owned by Jews, kosher restaurants. Do they have to tovel their dishes? No. This is only if a Jew owns it, it has to be toveled. What if it's a partnership? What if there are two partners, a Jew and a non-Jew? Do they have to tovel their kalim? Also not. In fact, One time I went to the Kela Mikveh in Queens, in Kew Garden Hills, and there was a guy there with just cases and cases of glasses and silverware. And I said to him, "You opening up a restaurant? What's going on here?" So he told me the story. He said, no, he actually owns a restaurant, and he had a non-Jewish partner, and he just bought him out. So because he bought the guy, he didn't realize this at the time, but because he bought the guy out, now everything has to be toveled. But the idea is, if there is a partial ownership by a non-Jew, so if someone is stuck and they can't tovel something and they really need it, you can sell it to Pete. If you sell Pete your dishes and then ask to borrow them, or if you even sell him a partnership in it, then you don't have to tovel it and you can use it. So if you find yourself, so this comes up. So, for example, let's say I own a factory, and I buy a huge cauldron that we're going to mix the whatever in. There's no mikveh that I could drop this in. So what do I do in that case? So the two possibilities, either I drill a hole in it and I fix the hole, now it was made by me, or...
Holes like at the top where
no, you make it, no, you make it on the bottom where it does bother anyone. That's A. Or the second possibility is I sell this pot to a non-Jew, etc., who will have partial ownership of it, and that will avoid the need to tovel.
On the disposable, sorry, just getting back to that.
Yeah.
Let's say you make a tray of chicken and you serve it, and there's a lot of chicken left, and you put it back in the fridge, and then you serve it the next time.
That's still one use. Right, only if.
What happens with electric?
Ah, that was the next topic. The George Foreman grill.
Okay.
Right? Or the
Shabbos,
toaster.
Or
the Shabbos kettle.
What?
The
right, or the Shabbos pot.
Yeah.
Right. So those all should be toveled. Aye, but it's going to ruin it? It's not. Right. So the idea, if you should, after you tovel it, you should let it dry first, right? You should unplug it before you tovel it, number one. Well, maybe I should just state the obvious. And then if it sits, I think some people say 24 hours is enough. Some people say 72 hours. If it dries out, it's not a problem. And that has been the experience. If you plug it in shortly thereafter, then you're going to have a problem. So in the event that there's something that would definitely get ruined, so then that would be a case where you could rely on selling part of it to a non-Jew. You can sell it to Antonia.
Who's going to buy it?
Antonia for sure. Nelly, not so much. But Antonia. Right. Pete, undoubtedly. And all these years he brought our chametz, he'd go for this as well. No, it's only partially. You sold her 5% of it. I wouldn't worry about Antonia. Oh, come on, I know. We know her better than that. Right? So in terms of now, let's talk about a toaster oven or the like. You only have to tovel the part that touches the food. So again, if you can take out the racks, that's fine. I got today an email from somebody who sent me, he just bought a new grill, a barbecue, and he sent me a schematic diagram of it. And he said to me, what has to be toveled? So I told him, only the grates. The grates are similarly on the George Foreman grills, the ones that have the removable grates.
Those are ceramic.
No, some are ceramic. The more expensive ones are ceramic, but the majority are still metal.
Mine were pretty cheap. I think it's ceramic.
I don't know. So take a magnet.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Right? If it sticks, you got a problem. That's fine.
No, it's not okay.
I think it is okay.
Nope.
Only whatever's going to touch the food. Whatever is not touching the food is not a problem.
If it touches,
it touches accidentally. It's not meant to be doing that. We will discuss later on, right, if you're cutting something fleshy with a milchig knife, so to figure out shishim, how much is the knife? We assume it's the blade, not the handle. The handle has nothing to do with it.
So you only have to worry about the wooden handles.
Wooden handles are fine.
Okay.
Are you saying that my toaster, which is not a toaster oven, can be immersed in a mixer?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, we did.
Do not immerse in.
when I was a student, my roommate was Rabbi Tzvi Sabolovsky, and he gives shiur all the time, and he tells the following story about this. You'll laugh at us, but here's what our dorm room looked like. We had a sink, and next to the sink there was this little fridge. On top of the fridge, we had an answering machine. And this happened around once a week. Our sink was always clogged. So it was always full of water. And every time you closed the fridge, the answering machine fell into the water. This happened. For some reason, we just kept on doing it. You just take out the milk, close the fridge, plop, done. And every time, I will tell you, that we let it dry out for a day or two. We changed the micro cassette that was in there because that got ruined, and it was good to go. So he says that we toiled our answering machine repeatedly, and we never had a problem with it.
But the answering machine doesn't have those. I mean, the toaster's got these electric coils and.
Well, I would think that the electronics in a answering machine is probably finer than it is in your toaster. I don't. Once you dry it out. It's good to go. I remember actually one time giving a shiur about this many years ago, and one of the students got up and said, "Rabbi, I'm not telling you about halacha, but I can tell you we have it, and what we do in our apartment is when it gets dirty, we just fill up the sink with water, and we drop it in, and we leave it overnight, we dry it, and that's it. That's how we actually clean it."
Clean what?
Their George Foreman grill. They just throw it in. They tovel it. They said never had a problem with it. What? I've heard of the Keurig, but I think
that it has to be tovel?
I don't think so. I think the way it works, right? I don't think that there's anything metal in it that actually does any of that does the cooking, as far as I know. So I think practically it just doesn't have to. Okay, I think people are showing up for mincha now.
Thank you.
We will continue. Everyone should.